Well, as Hamlet would say, there's the rub. I am not terribly encouraging. I have come to recognize this. Just in general, when people tell me about difficult things, my immediate response is, well, sure, you have to walk through the fire, and then when you get past it, then you feel this sense of relief because it's over. And apparently no one else seems to think of that as very encouraging, which has been disappointing for me, and I haven't quite reconciled myself to that reality. So I'm going to attempt to identify a particular place where I see God encouraging someone, and that's why I'm going to take you to 1 Kings chapter 19. But I want to put this in two very odd pieces of context. Years ago, a friend of mine, you remember Juman? So years ago, I was having these long conversations about God with someone who certainly grew up without any interest in God and wasn't so sure about this Christianity thing anyway. And the best compliment I got at one point, he'd gone to a couple CYC events, I think at that point, was, "I like you Christadelphians." He said, "Everyone else, when they're talking about the end of the world, they're terrified, they want to run to the hills and, you know, dig a giant hole in the ground. You guys, you hear about the end of the world, you want to pull out deck chairs and, you know, say hooray." And it was a very unexpected for me thing to say, but I thought about it and I thought, yeah, that is true. We talk about things, and I think I have this certain unexpected thought, like, you know, you hear war in the Middle East and we think, yeah, but is it going to be really big? Like really big, because then that'll be the good one. And it'll be the war to end all wars, and we get to the good stuff. If it's just a little war, though, a lot of people are going to die, a lot of people are going to suffer, and there's no hope in that. So it has occurred to me that possibly my mindset is geared toward really big disasters, because I see some sign of encouragement in that. But the little everyday grueling agonies that we go through, I find myself reflecting, well, what am I supposed to learn from this? What's the point? What am I gaining in terms of my spiritual life and development from this? Which is going to take me sort of backwards and then forwards. First Thessalonians chapter 5 has the nice encouragement line that probably came to your mind first, at least it did to mine, when the term encouragement comes up. Being as I am going to start with the least encouraging part and then walk forward to the encouraging bit. So I'll start with the less encouraging opening. Well, let's start up around verse 4. "But you, brothers, are not in darkness, so that this day should surprise you like a thief. You're all sons of the light and sons of the day. We do not belong to the night or to the darkness. So then, let us not be like others who are asleep, but let us be alert and self-controlled. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be self-controlled, putting on faith and love as a breastplate, and the hope of salvation as a helmet. For God did not appoint us to suffer wrath, but to receive salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ. He died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as, in fact, you are doing." I don't think I'm one of the people encouraging. I probably should be. I recognize this. But when I think of the things that we are doing to honor Christ, usually about as good as I get is, it's going to be really, really, really bad. And then you get the happy ending with Christ's return. And that's true. And for me, it is the fundamental basis of my sense of comfort in God. But it doesn't always help me in the moment. And I think that's why I really empathize with Elijah. Every once in a while, when we go through the readings, or this has appeared as a topic in Bible classes, I'll hear every emphasis on that. There's 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. I mean, come on, Elijah, what are you whining about? Come on, get up and go back to the death threats. Being a person who has rarely been threatened with death, however, I take that one kind of seriously. So if you don't mind just walking with this, I'm going to give you what I am seeing today in 1 Kings chapter 19 and tell you how this hits me as something that regularly comes up in the life of a believer. Not an unbeliever. They've got a different journey to walk. But the life of a believer for whom these questions of pain, of suffering, of doubt are real and things which we must bring to God. So here's what I see. Elijah once upon a time was part of a fairly large community of sons of the prophets, of people who were believers, who spoke and told Ahab he had done the wrong thing. These are people who are appointed by God to speak God's word. These are prophets, God's holy ones, not just believers, but ones who've been entrusted with a particular mission, right? To speak truth to power. And they get butchered. So here are people who are appointed by God to serve this purpose, to speak to a king who is doing evil things. And they die. And it's not just one prophet, it's this whole group, this whole community of prophets. Their belief does not save them. Their acting on behalf of God does not save them. Their doing what is right and just and true does not save them. They are not granted mercy. They are not granted escape. So when Elijah does this particularly spectacular thing, I have trouble with it because I think instinctively I want to say, but you know it's going to be all right. You got fed by ravens before. You know this is going to work out. And it wasn't until relatively recently looking at this again, I thought, no, he doesn't. Why should he know that it will work out? Why should he assume that he will be safe? Prophets have died before at the hands of evil kings, and they died after at the hands of evil kings also. Being the chosen of God does not necessarily mean it works out all right, as we are here to testify. In this world, evil men rule. This is the time of darkness for the sons of light. So, when we get this framed, and it's a shame in a sense you're taking one chapter and it maybe comes a little out of context, I do think it is worth prefacing with the knowledge Elijah is not a coward. Elijah is someone who is recognizing this very painful reality that his friends and companions have done what is right, have spoken God's word in truth, and have suffered. And now he is alone. And the fairly reasonable corollary will be, Ahab will be punished for what he does. He will have to face God's wrath and justice. But that does not necessarily mean at all that Elijah will be spared. So, how upset is he? Well, pretty spectacularly upset. He gets this death threat from Jezebel, and here's what he does. He goes about 100 miles south, and he gets on the other side of the border. Right? So he gets out of the kingdom of Samaria, and he doesn't stop in Jerusalem. He doesn't stop anywhere. He goes all the way down to Beersheba. Right? He gets as far from the border as possible. Doesn't want anyone accidentally straying over the border and accidentally assassinating him. He gets out of there. And then he ditches his servant in town, leaves him in Beersheba, and then he goes another day's journey into the wilderness. And I completely accept the possibility of climactic change over the last several thousand years. That said, it's still the wilderness. This is not a comfortable place to be. He's going to end up under a broom bush, broom tree, translate as you will. It's a big fluffy desert plant with pretty flowers on it in the spring, which is most famous for being useful to keep you warm at night because of its coals. Apparently it burns slow and hot. Great firewood in the desert. So he stops under the tree, bush, what have you, and talks to God. No witnesses, no one else is there. He is alone, and he has isolated himself. And he is speaking in such despair, he's literally saying, "Please, God, take my life. I am no better than my father's." Okay. And for those of us who've been reading sequentially, right, we look at chapter 18 and say, but look at what you just brought about. This was a significant moment. And then it was over. And he's on the run. And there's just him. And here he is, alone in the desert, and he's despairing, and he's ready to just stop. Can he just please stop? Saying the word of God is a dangerous thing in Ahab's kingdom. It gets you killed. And here he's saying to God, please just take my life. I'm really done. Now, I think sometime, I wish I could say it was just when I was a teenager, but it's probably more recent than that. I've read through this and thought, oh, Elijah, don't you know? No, I don't think he does. And I don't think there's any reason he should. Will God's justice prevail? Of course. Will God's mercy prevail? Yes. Before or after he's killed? Completely open question. So his despair, I will assert, is a very logical, reasonable thing for a faithful person to realize when bad things are happening to the faithful. And you realize there is no magic shield of protection that will keep you safe. That is not how God works with his faithful. That we will be exposed to dangers and are often intentionally exposed to dangers because the people who just kind of kept quiet and did not bow the knee to Baal but did not say anything against the king either, well, they were pretty safe, as long as they just kept it really quiet. So, next bit, and I'll just do a summary and then let me tell you some of the things I get out of this. He talks to God, pours out his heart, says whatever he needs to say, and then that's it. He falls asleep. And God wakes him with food and water. He eats, drinks. There's nothing more for him to say. He goes back to sleep. God wakes him again. Food, water. And this time, he's put on this journey. 40 days, 40 nights. I don't know. Your dad might have hiked that at some point. I don't think I can dream of it. Walking for 40 days, 40 nights does not sound like my idea of a fun time. And if we look at where he's going, total moment of my personal caveat, I still read Mount Horeb as Mount Sinai. For those of you who like to do, there's two mountains of God, one's Sinai, one's Horeb. Tell me all about it afterward. We can disagree. But at least directionally, he is going to be walking down, following the 40 years wandering in reverse, going down to where the burning bush was. That much I think we all agree on. If we're agreeing on early chapters of Deuteronomy, this is also where the Ten Commandments are given. He is told to go to a place of very serious significance. He's not told to go to Jerusalem. He's not told to go to the temple. He's told to go south, to leave God's people, to leave Israel, and to go down, 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 down through the desert. 40 days wandering, not fun. 40 days and nights walking through the desert is maddening. It also shouldn't take that long, by the way. So he's probably not going a direct route. This is moving around through the desert until he finally gets there. 40 days, 40 nights. It's a little weird, but it's interesting. Clearly there's some specific purpose here. Okay. He gets there and again speaks to God. And God replies. Then he gets this spectacular show. Here he is up on the mountain again. Location of the burning bush. This is a significant place. He knows why this location matters. He is given a vision of the power of God, but it's not God. The power of God, but it's not God. The power of God, not God. And then he gets this, still small voice, and I'm speaking fairly loudly this time. I know, people have told me I murmur, and it's true. Serious things, I drop down to a whisper. Can you hear me, Tom? Am I still doing okay? I'll try. I really will this time. So he gets through all this. He hears this voice, and the voice does not tell him, it's okay, I will be with you, you're going to live. The voice does not tell him, I will protect you and keep you safe. The voice does not tell him lots of things. Instead, it tells him something that, for most of us, if this was the first time we'd ever been going through this narrative, should have been kind of surprising. It seems like completely out of left field advice, or command. It's a very odd set of instructions. And it gets mixed in with this repeated question, why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? Go and do this. Now that you have wandered all the way south to the Sinai Peninsula, now you're going to go up north, heading for Lebanon, Syria, right? So now that you've left Israel one direction, you're going to leave Israel the other direction. You're going to do a lot of walking. It's going to be part of this. And in that, you are going to find a complete change in the situation as you understand it. And there is going to be someone who is going to take your place. Okay. That's how I'm looking at this chapter in summary. These are some of the things I get out of it. First, foremost, and the last, God is there. God is there with Elijah under a broom bush in the middle of the desert. Not just in Jerusalem, not just at Horeb, not just in the sacred places. God is there with him always. Even when he's ditched his servant, God's there speaking to him, acting in his life. Cooking him food, which is fascinating and kind of spectacular in its own way. Bread baked on coals, jar of water, that's interesting. Another classic thing, and I've said it before, but I'm going to say it one more time, bad things always happen to good people. This isn't the weird discrepancy. Elijah is not the strange, odd one. Like, wow, all the prophets had always been protected and safe, and then there was this guy. This is really significant, by the way, if you ever have serious conversations with folks about prophets in Islam. You ask any traditional Muslim, prophets are kept safe and will never be harmed. That's why they have a really fun walk around with Jesus, who everyone will assert is a prophet, and therefore, how did that whole crucifixion thing work out? A fascinating conversation, I highly recommend having it. Next time you have a nice lunch conversation with a serious Muslim, ask them about prophets and protection. Because if there is ever a significant discrepancy between the Bible and the Quran, that is a huge one. In the Quran, if you're a prophet, you're fine. Nothing will touch you. The Bible doesn't show it that way at all. Next one. Good people get tired of bad things happening to them. Even the righteous don't always say, one more time, I can take some more punishment. Even the prophets get tired of the pain and the loneliness and the struggle. Even the prophets get depressed. Even the prophets despair. Another thing I really love about this is how God replies. Because again, recognizing in myself that I am very bad at encouraging, here's what usually happens when I'm talking to someone and I think I need to encourage this person. I say something along the lines of, it's going to be all right. And I'm lying. Because one, I have no such assurance. And two, it probably isn't. Not this side of Christ's return. It is not going to be all right. Or as my mother used to say, the best thing that Job's three friends ever did was sit down with him in silence. The real problem started when they opened their mouths. So speaking as a miserable counselor, I'm fascinated to see what God does, because honestly, for years, this has struck me as the most bizarre thing. God doesn't say, fear not, it will be all right. He doesn't get that at all. Instead, he gets, get up and eat. It's very practical. There's no platitudes, there's no homilies, there's no ostensible words of comfort. It's eminently practical. Okay, you're in despair, you're in agony, you're ready to just drop it all. Okay, get up and eat. Okay, go ahead. You've fallen asleep again. One more time. Get up and eat. This is going to be really hard for you. You're going to need this. And then God does not make it easy on this guy. If he wanted to reveal his power and glory, why not a day's walk outside of Beersheba? Is God everywhere? Yes. Does he do miraculous things right there under the broom tree? Yes. But instead, God basically tells him, this is going to be really hard. You are going to have to walk through the desert. But where seems to matter? He's taking Elijah to a place in which clearly everything started. This is where Moses' life was transformed. He's 40 years old. He tried to save the people as a prince, failed as a prince. Here he is. He's a shepherd. Who knows what's going to happen to Israel? And there's a burning bush. If, as I say, I still think Horeb, Sinai, same thing. You can argue with me later. If this is the place where the Ten Commandments are given, this is all the more significant, right? Moses is up there for 40 days and 40 nights without food or water. Seems like a pretty strong parallel is being made. We are getting, in a sense, a reenactment of this very close, personal, face-to-face relationship where God is speaking to someone as a man speaks to his friend. We are getting this moment of the revealing of God. It's what Moses had asked for before. It's what Elijah is being given without being asked this time. God is going to reveal himself to Elijah. He will have all of the comfort of knowing that God is truly there, present, active with him. And it strikes me that, fundamentally, the location impacts, at least the way we hear, the message. There are certainly going to be times and places in which you can tell me something and it is right and true and it should change my life, and I am physically not in the right place to hear it. And I will not perceive and will not understand what you are saying. For some reason, Elijah, who was at that point of despair, literally had to have that 40 days of silence, not hearing God's voice, just walking, just wandering, going and going and traveling to be at the place where he could hear the words he needed to hear. And that for me is eminently human. That sounds like what happens in those moments of a faithful person when we are trying to get to the place where God's words will speak to us, that we can hear them and take them in. I guess the big thing I'm getting out of this is you really have to walk a lot. And even though clearly God is speaking to him at the beginning and at the end, for a large part of it, it's going to feel like he's walking alone. Remember, he ditched his servant back in Beersheba. He's got nobody there to help him with anything. He's not a terribly young man. He's got a lot to do. And this is a harsh and difficult journey. As far as I can tell, in nothing like a straight line. He's going to wander until he gets to the mountain. Climb that mountain. And again, I know we all argue over which mountain is the right mountain. Is Catherine's monastery even close? But you look around at all those things, none of them is going to be easy to climb. They're pretty rough ascents. There's no smooth, soft pathway up to any of these mountains. If you are going up to spend a night in a cave in one of those, expect it to be pretty grueling, and that's after getting through the desert. And yet, God makes him do all of this. And it seems mean. It also seems really right. Because there's something about that place that says beginning, renewal. God's presence with you. That what you are going to hear in this place will completely change your life and will completely change your future. And will completely change the future of the community, not just you. The burning bush wasn't just about Moses' life. Neither was the Ten Commandments. And what happens for Elijah changes a lot of things. The other part that's fascinating is that God makes this point of showing his power versus his voice. I like to look for God in really big, spectacular things. Right? Definitely a significant part of our prayer life. We were talking about, here is Israel after 1900 repetitions of next year in Jerusalem. Finally, it was in Jerusalem. And there is a nation in Israel again. Has that been significant? Has that been huge? Is that spectacular? And does it draw my attention? Yes. Does it mean I think that I often ignore the small voice that is with me? Probably. Let me just read this little bit here. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Clearly God knows the answer. So it's not one of those multiple choice questions where you have to get it right in order for the teacher to pat you on the head and say, "Good boy, you said the right catechism answer." It really seems to be a moment of, you've had 40 days to think about this. Why are you here? I made you walk all this way. What are you physically doing here? What's the point? What's going through your head? Why am I doing this for you? What next stage are you going to in your life? What's being achieved here? And the response is pretty much the same every time. What are you doing here? Well, where is here for Elijah? Here is, I've been very zealous, and he has been very zealous. I mean, we've read through the earlier chapters. We know what's going on here. This is not someone who occasionally worships God and then, you know, runs on the other hand. This has been a very significant person in the history of his nation and the history of God's people. Then he's pointing to everybody else. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've broken down your altars and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me. It's honest. He's the last one. God let the others die. What about him? What's next for him? And the reply is, the Lord said to him, go back the way you came, and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel, and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah to succeed you as prophet. Okay, first, he walked 40 days to get here. Now the word is, go back the way you came, and then go farther. Right? Go all the way up to another desert, go to the desert of Damascus. And you're going to find someone who is not of the chosen people, who has no connection with them, and you're going to anoint him as king. Fascinating, weird, surprising. Then you're going to anoint this person who is not in the royal household at all, king over Israel. Fascinating, you can see where that's going to go on the whole showdown with Ahab. Fine. And then you're going to anoint someone to succeed you as prophet. Now, I have definitely had moments in which people have read this as, well, you complained, so now I'm going to get a new guy who won't complain so much, and he's going to get your job because you wimped out at the end. That strikes me as both surprising, considering God's behavior towards complaining prophets, and certainly not indicative of what happens. Elijah's going to have to go back to work. At the best, you can say Elisha gets to do an apprenticeship with him and learn what comes next. But what's fascinating about it seems to come down to this for me. When a believer turns to God for comfort, we do not get what we want instantly. There is no, I'm sorry, this must be really difficult for you, let me fix it like this. There's a lot of, you are going to walk through the desert. And I am going to change everything. And you are going to be the instrument of change. This is not, I am going to anoint Hazael, king over Aram. I am going to anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi. I am going to anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat. Could have been, but it isn't. It's not God will do these personnel changes in order to make it easier for you. It's you are going to go and do this. And these people that you appoint, that you anoint, that you act and transform their lives are going to change yours. And that is certainly true. Elisha is going to be a son to Elijah. Elisha is going to be a servant to Elijah. Elisha is going to be a successor and the fulfillment of his hopes. Elisha is going to be everything that Elijah needed. And it's not a quick solution, it's not an instant solution, and it requires daily and consistent work from Elijah. But he's going to have that moment. From this point on, he will not be the only one left. It's not the 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal, but are very, very quiet and hide. There will be someone else walking with him, doing the work, speaking. So that even if Elijah dies, even if he is killed by Jezebel's assassins, the work will continue. And the thing that has struck me in my worst moments and continues to strike me when I talk to people about moments of despair. Half of it is we want to know, will the work continue without us? Will these dreams we have, will these goals we have be achieved if we fail? What happens if we can't do what we need to do? Will it be accomplished? And that is what God uses to comfort Elijah, to comfort his prophet. You have despaired. There will be someone to complete the work. You are going to be like Moses. You will be entrusted with vision, with the word, with power, with glory. You will not go into the Holy Land. You're going to watch Joshua go into the Holy Land. You're going to watch Elisha be the one who brings about this end game. And ultimately, for us, it's we will watch Christ bring about that which we could not. Because this is the life of every believer. We have these moments in which we recognize that we seem to be powerless to do that which we crave and need and desire. The good which we wish to do, we are unable to do. And we're confronted with things that will destroy us. And then we're asked to turn to the person who will accomplish what we hope for. Ultimately, for us, it always returns to Christ. And to the recognition that at every moment, especially our moment of despair, God is there. And whether or not we hear his voice walking in the desert, he is there. Until we are in the place where we can hear him speak softly, it will be done. And I don't know how encouraging that will be, but I know it's true. And the end, it will be all right, isn't true ever until everything is all right. And that's our comfort. And I hope it is encouraging.